This is The Experiment by Julian Barnes, read by Josh Knowles. Two things before I start. One, I don't have an English accent, and I don't speak French, so bear with me. Here we go. His story didn't always begin in the same way. In the preferred version, my uncle was in Paris on business, traveling for a firm that produced authentic wax polish. He went into a bar and ordered a glass of white wine. The man standing next to him asked what his area of activity was, and he replied, "Si, royaliste." But I also heard my uncle tell it differently. For instance, he'd been taken to Paris by a rich patron to act as a navigator in a motor rally. The stranger in the bar, we're now at the Ritz, by the way, was refined and haughty, so my uncle's French duly rose to the occasion. Asked his purpose in the city, he replied, "Je suis, sir, royaliste." In a third, and it seemed to me most implausible version, the white wine in front of my uncle was a rouille. This, he would explain, came from a small appellation in the Loire, and was not unlike Sancerre in style. My uncle was new to Paris, and had already ingested several glasses, the location having shifted to a petite sink in the Quartier Latin, so that when the stranger, who this time was not haughty, asked what he was drinking, he felt that panic which occurs when a foreign idiom escapes the mind, and the further panic when an English expression is desperately translated. The idiomatic model he chose was, "I'm on the beer." And so he said, "Je suis sur roulis." Once, when I rebuked my uncle for the contradictoriness of his memories, he gave a contented little smile. "Marvelous, the subconscious, isn't it?" he replied. "So inventive." If the neighboring drinker came in several physical forms, he likewise introduced himself variously as Tanguy, Privert, Duhamel, and Eunuch, once even as Breton himself. We can, at least, be sure of the date of this evanescent encounter, March, 1928. Further, my Uncle Freddy, as even the most cautious commentators have agreed, was, none other than the mildly disguised T.F., who appears in Session 5A of the Surrealist Group's famously unplatonic Dialogues About Sex. The transcript of this session was published for the first time in 1990, as an appendix to Recherches sur la Sexualité, January 1928 through August 1932. The notes state that my uncle was almost certainly introduced to the group by Pierre Eunuch, and that T.F., contrary to the subsequent meanderings of his own subconscious, was actually in Paris on holiday. There are about a dozen participants, according to my uncle, nine according to the Recherches. I should make it clear that since Session 5A was not published until 1990, and my uncle died in 1985, he was only ever faced with self-inflicted inconsistencies. Further, the tale of Uncle Freddy and the Surrealists was strictly for the smoking room, where narrative libertarianism was more acceptable. After swearing listeners never to mention it to Aunt Kate, he would enlarge on the frank licentiousness of what had taken place back in 1928. At times, he would claim to have been shocked, and maintained that he'd heard more filth in one evening among Parisian intellectuals than he had in 3 years of barrack life during the last war. At others, his self-presentation was as the English man about town, the card, the dandy, all too willing to pass on a few tips, a few handy refinements of technique, to this gathering of Frenchmen whose cerebral intensity, in his view, hampered their normal central responses. The published session, needless to say, confirms neither version. Those who have read the Recherches will be familiar with its strange mixture of pseudoscientific inquiry and frank subjective response. The truth is that everyone talks about sex in a different way, just as everyone, we naturally assume, does it in a different way. André Breton, animator of the group, is a lofty Socratic figure, austere and at times repellent. "I don't like anyone to caress me. I hate that." The others are variously benign to cynical, self-mocking to boastful, candid to satirical. The dialogues are happily full of humor, occasionally of the unintended sort, inflicted by posterity's frigid judgment, but more often intended, issuing from a rueful acknowledgement of our human frailty. I'm straying from the point. I'm probably also trying to put off the admission that my uncle's participation in Session 5A is, for most of its extent, frankly disappointing. Perhaps there was a false democracy in the assumption that an Englishman picked up in a bar because of a verbal mistake would have important testimony to offer this probing tribunal. T.F. is asked many of the usual questions, under which conditions he prefers to have sex, how he lost his virginity, whether and how he can tell if a woman has reached orgasm, how many people he's had sexual relations with, and so on. I shall not bother to relate my uncle's responses, because they are either banal or, I suspect, not wholly truthful. I'm not surprised that Session 5A is relegated to an appendix. The interrogators and fellow confessors are in a lethargic or routine mood, while the surprise witness keeps pleading the fifth. Then, towards the end of the evening, there comes a moment when the Englishman's presence seems briefly justified. I feel I should give, at this point, the transcript in full. André Breton. What is your opinion of love? When two people get married. No. The word marriage is anti-surrealist. This is Jean Baldensperger. What about sexual relations with animals? What do you mean? Sheep? Donkeys? There are very few donkeys kneeling. We had a pet rabbit. Did you have relations with your rabbit? No. Did you dream of having relations with your rabbit? No. I cannot believe that your sexual life can possibly be as empty of imagination and surrealism as you make it appear. This is Pierre Eunuch. Can you describe to us the principal differences between sexual relations with an English woman and those with a French woman? I only arrived in France yesterday. Are you frigid? No, do not take offense. I'm not serious. Perhaps I can make a contribution, but by describing something I used to dream about. Did they wear donkeys? No. There used to be a pair of twin sisters on my street. You wanted to have sexual relations with both of them at the same time. How old were they? Were they young girls? You're excited by lesbianism? You like to watch women caress one another? Please, gentlemen, let our guests speak. I know we are surrealists, but this is chaos. I used to look at these twin sisters, who were in all visible respects identical, and ask how far that identity continued. You mean, if you were having sexual relations with one, how could you tell it was she and not the other? Exactly. At the beginning. And this, in turn, provoked a further question. What if there were two people, women who in their sexual movements were exactly the same, and yet in all other respects were completely different? Erotic doppelgangers, yet social disparates. Precisely, that is a valuable contribution, even, if I may say so to our English guests, a quasi-surrealist contribution. So you have not been in bed with a French woman? I told you, I arrived yesterday. This is the end of Uncle Freddy's documented participation in Session 5A. I had, of course, no suspicion of this future corroboration when I saw my uncle for the last time. This was in November 1984. Aunt Kate was dead by then, and my visits to TF, as I'm inclined to think of him nowadays, had been increasingly dutiful. Nephews tend to prefer aunts to uncles. Aunt Kate was dreamy and indulgent. There was something gauzy-scarved and secretive about her. Uncle Freddy was indecently foursquare. He seemed to have his thumbs in his waistcoat pockets, even when wearing a two-piece suit. His stance, both moral and physical, had the bullying implication that he truly understood what manhood consisted of, that his generation had miraculously caught the elusive balance between earlier repression and subsequent laxness, and that any deviation from this beau ideal was regrettable, if not actively perverse. As a result, I was never quite at ease with the future TF. It had become a routine after Aunt Kate's death that I would take Uncle Freddy out to dinner on his birthday, and that afterwards we'd return to his flat off the Cromwell Road and drink ourselves stupid. The consequences mattered little to him, but I had my patience to think of, and would annually try to avoid getting as drunk as I had the previous year. I can't say I ever succeeded, because, though each year my resolution was stronger, so was the countervailing force of my uncle's tediousness. In my experience, there are various good, but lesser motives. Guilt, fear, misery, happiness, for indulging in a certain excess of drink, and one larger motive for indulging in a great excess. Boredom. At one time, I knew a clever alcoholic who insisted that he drank because then things happened to him, such as they never did when he was sober. I half believed him, though, to my mind, drink does not really make things happen. It simply helps you bear the pain of things not happening. For instance, the pain of my uncle being exceptionally boring on his birthdays. The ice would fissure as it hit the whiskey. The casing of the gas fire would clunk. Uncle Freddy would light what he claimed was his annual cigar, and the conversation would turn, yet again, to what I now think of as Session 5A. So, remind me, Uncle, what were you really doing in Paris?
Trying to make ends meet, what all young men do.
We were on our second half bottle of whiskey. A third would be required before a welcome enough form of anesthesia developed.
Task of the male throughout history, wouldn't you say?
And did you?
Did I what?
Make ends meet.
You've a filthy mind for one of your age,
he said, with the sudden sideways aggression that liquor imparts. Chip off the old block, Uncle Freddy. I didn't, of course, mean it.
Did I ever tell you?
And he was launched. if that verb doesn't give too vivid an impression of directness and purpose. This time he'd again chosen to be in Paris as a map reader and mechanic to some English my lord. What sort of car was it? Just out of interest. Panhard, he answered sniffly. He was always a panhard when he told this version. I used to divert myself by wondering whether such consistency on my uncle's part made this element of his story more likely to be true or more likely to be false. And where did the rally go?
Uphill and down dale, my boy, round and about, from one end of the land to the other.
I caressed him with the questions he needed until he reached the normal climax of his story, one of the few points at which he agreed with the subsequently published Session 5A.
So, fellow me lad says to me, have you done it with a French lass yet? And I say, give us time. I only got off the boat yesterday.
I would normally have feigned a run of dying chuckles, poured some more scotch, and waited for Uncle Freddy's next topic. This time, for some reason, I declined his ending.
So did you?
Did I what?
Do it with a French lass. I was breaking the rules, and his reply was a kind of rebuke, or at least I took it as such.
Your Aunt Kate was pure as driven snow, he announced with a hiccup. The missing doesn't get any the less, you know, for all the years. I can't wait to join her.
Never say die, Uncle Freddy. I repeated, so, did you do it with a French lass?
Thereby hangs a tale, my boy, and it's one I've never told a living soul.
I think if I'd shown genuine interest at this point, I might have scared him off. But I was slumped in the oppressive reflection that my uncle was not just an old boar, but a parody of an old boar.
Thereby hangs a tale, and it's one I've never told a living soul.
People don't say that anymore, except my uncle just had.
They fixed me up, you see.
Who fixed you up?
The Surrealist boys, my newfound chums.
You mean they found you a job?
Are you stupid tonight, or just normal? I'm not sure I can tell. They fixed me with a woman. Well, two, to be precise.
I began to pay attention at this point. Needless to say, I did not believe my uncle. He was probably fed up with the lack of impact made by the umpteenth retelling of How I Met the Surrealists, and had been working up some new embellishment.
You see, in my considered opinion, these get-togethers, they all wanted to meet up and talk smut, but they couldn't admit it. So they said there was some scientific purpose behind it all. Fact is, they weren't good at talking smut. Inhibited, really, I suppose I'd say. Intellectuals. No fire in their veins. Just ideas. Well, in my 3 years at the army,
I'll spare you this ritual diversion.
So, I could make sense what they were after, but I wasn't going to provide it. Almost like betraying your country, talking smut in front of a group of foreigners. Unpatriotic, don't you think?
Never tried it, Uncle.
Huh, you've got a good tongue on tonight. Never tried it. That was just like them, wanting to know what I'd never tried. Trouble with their sort is, if you say you've never wanted to do so-and-so, they don't believe you. In fact, just because you say you don't want to do so-and-so, they assume that deep down, this is what you're bursting to do. Cockeyed, eh. Could be. So I thought it incumbent upon me to raise the tone of the gathering. Don't laugh, I know what I'm saying. You wait till you find yourself sitting around with a lot of intellectuals all talking about John Thomas. So I said, here's one to think about. What if there were two lasses who made love in the same way? Exactly the same way. So that if you closed your eyes, you couldn't tell the difference. Wouldn't that be a thing, I said. And with all their brains, they hadn't turned up that conundrum before. Set them by the ears, I don't mind telling you. I'm not surprised. It's one of those questions you tend not to ask, neither about yourself. Is there someone else out there who does it in a way indistinguishable from me? Nor about others. In sex, we note distinctiveness, not similarity. She, slash he, is, slash was, good, slash not good, slash wonderful, slash bit boring, slash fakey, or whatever. We don't, as a rule, think, oh, being in bed with her is much like being in bed with so-and-so a couple years ago. In fact, if I were to close my eyes, we don't, on the whole, think that way. Courtesy, in part, I expect. A desire to maintain the individuality of others. And perhaps a fear that if you do that to them, they might start thinking the same back about you. So my new chums fixed me up.
Huh?
They wanted to thank me for my contribution to their discussions. Seeing as how I'd been so useful, Chappie I'd met in the bar said he'd be in touch. The next day, he turned up and said the group was offering me what he called a surrealist gift. They were touched by the fact that I had not as yet enjoyed the favors of a French lass, and they were prepared to right this wrong. Remarkably generous. A remarkable fantasy was what I really thought. He said they'd book a room for me at 3 o'clock the next afternoon in a hotel off St. Sulpice, He said he'd be there too. I thought this a bit strange, but on the other hand, never look a gift horse and all that. What are you going to be there for, I asked. I think I'm up to managing my own. So he explained the arrangement. They wanted me to take part in a test. They wanted to know if sex with a French woman was different from sex with an English woman. I said, why did they need me to help them find that out? They said they thought I'd have a more straightforward response, meaning, I suppose, that I wouldn't sit around and think about it all the time like they would. I said, let me get this straight. You want me to come and have a couple hours with a French lass, and then come around the next day and tell you what I thought of it? No, Chappie says. Not the next day. Day after. The next day, we booked you in the same room with another girl. That's handsome, I say. Two French lasses for the price of one. Not quite, he says. One of them is English. You have to tell which is which. Well, I say, I can tell it just by saying bonjour and looking at them. That's why, he says, you aren't allowed to say bonjour. And you aren't allowed to look at them. I'll be there when you arrive and I'll blindfold you, and then I'll let the girl in. When she's gone and you hear the door shut, you can take the blindfold off. How do you feel about that? How did I feel about that? Well, it was a bit of a surprise. I'd just been thinking, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. And now it was a question of not looking two gift horses in the mouth, or anywhere else. How did I feel? Man to man, it felt like a couple Christmases had come around at the same time. Part of me wasn't too partial about the blindfold business, though, man to man, another part of me really was. Isn't it pathetic how old men lie about the sex they had in their earlier days? What could be more transparently an invention? Paris, youth, a woman, two women, a hotel room in the afternoon, all set up and paid for by someone else? Pull the other one, uncle. 20 minutes in a hotel de passe, with a rough hand towel and a subsequent dose of the clap is more like it. Why do old men need this sort of comfort? And what banal scenarios they drool out to themselves. Okay, uncle. Fast forward with the soft porn. So I said, count me in. And then next afternoon I went to this hotel behind St. Sulpice. It came on to rain, and I had to run from the metro station, and got there in a muck sweat. This wasn't bad. I'd been expecting a brilliant spring day, with accordionists serenading him through the Jardin du Luxembourg. I got to the room. Chappie was there, took off my hat and coat. Wasn't planning on getting starkers in front of mine host, as you might imagine. He said, don't worry, she'll do the rest. He just sat me down on the bed, wrapped this scarf around my head, knotted it twice, made me promise as an Englishman not to do any peeping, and left the room. A couple minutes later, I heard the door open. My uncle put down his whiskey, set his head back, and closed his eyes, closing them to remember something he'd not in any case seen. Indulgently, I let him drag out the pause. At last, he said, and then the next day, again, raining again, too. The gas fire noisily held its breath. The ice cubes trilled promptingly in my glass. But Uncle Freddy didn't seem to want to continue. Or perhaps he'd really stopped. That wouldn't do. It was, how shall I put it, like a narrative teasing. So, my uncle repeated softly. Just so. We sat quietly for a minute or two, until I couldn't avoid the question. And what was the difference? Uncle Freddy put his head back, closed his eyes, and uttered a noise between a sigh and a whimper. Eventually, he said, the French lass licked the raindrops from my face. He opened his eyes again and showed me his tears. I was strangely moved. I was also wearily suspicious, but this didn't stop me being moved. The French lass licked the raindrops from my face. I gave my uncle, whether plausible liar or sentimental remembrancer, the gift of my envy. You could tell?
Tell what?
He seemed half absent, being tweaked and tickled by his memories. Which one was English and which one was French?
Oh yes, I could tell.
How?
How do you think?
Smell of garlic? He chuckled. No, they are both the same scent, as a matter of fact. Quite strong scent. Not the same, of course. So, they did different things. Or was it the way they did it?
Trade secret.
Now he was beginning to look smug again. Come off it, Uncle Freddy.
I always made it a rule never to snitch on my lady friends.
Uncle Freddy, you never set eyes on them. They're provided for you. They weren't your lady friends.
They were to me. Both of them. That's what they felt like. That's what I've always considered them.
This was exasperating. Not the least because I'd been drawn into giving credence to my uncle's fantasy. And what was the point of inventing a story and then withdrawing the key facts? But you can tell me, Uncle, because you told them.
Them?
The group. You reported it to them the next day.
Well, an Englishman's word is his bond, except when it isn't. You've lived long enough to know that. And besides, the truth is, I had a feeling, not so much the first time, but more strongly the second, that I was being watched.
Someone in the wardrobe.
I don't know. How? Where? Just sensed it somehow. It made me feel a bit grubby. And, as I say, I made it a rule never to snitch on my lady friends. So, I took the boat train home the next day. And that, my uncle continued, was the cleverest thing I ever did.
He looked at me as if his whole story had been aimed at this moment.
Because that's where I met your Aunt Kate. On the boat train.
I never knew that.
No reason why you should.
Engaged within the month, and married within 3.
A busy spring indeed.
And what did she think of your adventures?
His face shut down again. Your Aunt Kate was pure as driven snow. I'd no more have talked about that than pick my teeth in public.
You never told her.
Never breathed a word.
Anyway, imagine it from her side. She meets a likely fellow, gets a bit soft on him, asks what he's been up to in Paris, and he tells her he's been knocking off lasses at the rate of 1 a day after promising to go back afterwards and talk smut about them. She'd not be soft on him for long, would she?
In my limited observation, Aunt Kate and Uncle Freddy, despite their different natures, had been a devoted couple. His grief at her death, even when exaggerated into melodrama by drink, had seemed quite genuine. The fact that he survived her by 6 years, I attributed to no more than the enforced habit of living. 2 months after this final birthday evening, he gave up that habit. The funeral was the usual sparse and awkward business. A surrealist wreath with an obscene motive might have helped. And 5 years later, the Recherches sur la Sexualité appeared, and my uncle's story was partly corroborated. My curiosity and frustration were also revived. I was left staring at the same old questions. I resented the fact that my uncle had clammed up, leaving me with nothing but, "The French lass licked the raindrops from my face." As I have mentioned, my uncle's encounter with the surrealist group was relegated to a mere appendix. The Recherches are, of course, extensively annotated. Preface, introduction, text, appendices, footnotes to text, footnotes to appendices, footnotes to footnotes. Probably I'm the only person to have spotted something that is at most of only family interest. Footnote 23 to Session 5A states that the Englishman referred to as TF was on one occasion the subject of what is described to be as attempted vindication of surrealist theory, but that no record of the results obtained has survived. Footnote 12 to Appendix 6 describes these attempted vindications and mentions that in a few of them there was an Englishwoman involved. This woman is simply referred to as K.
I have only 2 final reflections on the matter. The first is that when scientists employ volunteers to help with their research projects, they often withhold from these participants the true purpose of the test, for fear such knowledge might, wittingly or unwittingly, affect the purity of the process and the accuracy of the result. The second thought came to me only quite recently. I may have mentioned that I take a novice interest in wine. I belong to a small group that meets twice a month. We each take along a bottle, and the wines are tasted blind. Usually we get them wrong, sometimes we get them right, though what is wrong and what is right in this matter is a complicated business. If a wine tastes to you like a young Australian Chardonnay, then that, in a sense, is what it is. The label may subsequently declare it to be an expensive Burgundy, but if it hasn't been that in your mouth, then that is what it can never truly become. This isn't quite what I mean to say. I meant to say that a couple weeks ago we had a guest tutor. She is a well-known master of wine, and she told us an interesting fact. Apparently, if you take a magnum and decant it into 2 separate bottles and put them into a blind tasting, then it's extremely rare for even wily drinkers to guess that the wine in those 2 particular bottles is in fact the same one. People expect all the wines to be different, and their palates therefore insist that they are. She said it was a most revealing experiment, and that it almost always works. Many thanks for reviewing my application. Go to Michael Cote, who calls me nearly every day to ask, "Did you have relations with your abbot?"